radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Of the Catholic Church in the other. Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
Draft a sensible conscience clause.
Never before has the federal government forced organizations to buy a product that violates their conscience.
If you think abortion's murder, should you have to pay for it?
You're asking the right question.
They have decided to declare war on the church.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Religious liberty will be protected.
Are you quite sure?
Federal conscience laws will remain in place.
But there's a lot more to his story, believe me.
This is the key.
We have a year to violate our consciences.
Never have I seen greater resolve on the part of Catholics.
I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
The American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Glad to have you at this hour. We're going to learn something that I would venture to say 99% of us don't know. In fact, in my particular case, I knew very little of what we're going to learn in this next hour because I knew very little about North Korea. My guest, Melanie Kirkpatrick, is a journalist, works with the Hudson Institute. She was deputy editor of the editorial page at the Wall Street Journal. But she's been following North Korea for a while, and she's chronicled the what they call the Asian Underground Railroad. It's the process and the routes by which men and women can escape North Korea through China, through Mongolia, and back into South Korea. Sometimes Sikh families that they've been separated from since the war. And the description of North Korea is as terrible as anything you can imagine for a sitting state. It is, well, in some ways, it's not dissimilar to like a nation that's a concentration camp. That might be overstating it, but the boundaries are clearly as firm as any concentration camp. We're going to take time talking with Melanie about this. And of course, what you'll learn in this conversation is, as usual, when there are corporal works of mercy to be performed, when there are human beings who need to be affirmed and protected and given solace, who's there? Again, it's Christians. This happens all the time. Everywhere you go in the world, this is the case, even in South Korea and in China, of all places. So, Melanie Kirkpatrick coming up with me. But first, let's hit the headlines.
Thank you very much, Al. Welcome, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, November 16th. It is the Feast of St. Margaret of Scotland, and today's news is brought to you in part by the St. Gregory Center for Drug and Alcohol Rehab at stgregoryctr.com. Former CIA Director David Petraeus is testifying in closed hearings on Capitol Hill about the deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya. Petraeus resigned last week in a sex scandal. Emerging from one hearing, New York Republican Congressman Peter King said Petraeus clearly labeled the incident as a planned terrorist attack.
They now clearly believe there was, did not arise out of a demonstration, it was not spontaneous, and it was clear terrorist involvement.
In the days immediately following the attack, the Obama administration called the attack the deadly result of a spontaneous protest. King chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. Petraeus is not expected to make any public remarks. A ceasefire proves to be short-lived in Gaza. Israel had said it would stop its offensive in the Gaza Strip during a visit by the Egyptian prime minister to the territory today. It was on the condition that rocket fire from Gaza into Israel would also stop during the three-hour visit. However, Palestinians continued cross-border rocket attacks, and Israel answered with airstrikes. Reports indicate rockets fired from Gaza struck several sites in southern Israel shortly after the arrival of the Egyptian official. Women prisoners held at the Century Regional Detention Facility in Linwood will have two special masses this Sunday morning with a special visit of the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Lucy Boutte with the Catholic Archdiocese of Los Angeles says the sacred icon has great significance in the Hispanic community.
Because Our Lady has always exemplified an outreach. She touches the hearts of all people, and especially people who are in dire straits, and obviously women in prison are suffering very much.
She says the visit to Lynnwood is part of the annual pilgrimage to select parishes in the five pastoral regions of Los Angeles. The company that makes Twinkies, Ding Dongs, and Wonder Bread is going out of business.
This is Twinkie the Kid. Ever wonder how they get that creamy filling into the middle of a Twinkies cake? Hostess Twinkies cakes, fruit pies, and cupcakes. Yahoo!
Hostess announced this morning that it's winding down operations and has filed a motion with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court seeking permission to shut its doors and sell its assets. And some observers believe the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court will remain unchanged during Obama's next term, barring a surprise retirement or death. Liberty Counsel's Matt Staver believes none of the conservatives will retire and that the likely retirement will be by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a liberal justice, since Obama's replacement choice would be liberal. It is not going to affect the court's balance. And now your fascinating fact for the day. The attachment of human skin to muscles is what causes dimples. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
I'm Al Cresta. It's good to be with you. Melanie Kirkpatrick is a journalist and serves as a Hudson Institute Senior Fellow. She's also served as deputy editor of the editorial page at the Wall Street Journal. She's picked up on a story that I've seen very little done on. And it's the untold story of Asia's Underground Railroad. It deals with the escape from North Korea. Now, you know, the way we tell the American story during the Civil War era, prior to the Civil War, you had the Underground Railroad here, which was a way of ferrying people, slaves, from slave states into free states and eventually out of the jurisdiction of slave states and, for a while, the federal government. But Melanie tells the harrowing story of the North Korean quest for liberty. And travelers on the new Underground Railroad there include women bound to Chinese men who purchased them as brides. You've got defectors carrying state secrets, POWs from the Korean War held captive in the North for more than a half century. And it's a fascinating story, and she tells it well in the book Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. Melanie, it's good to have you here. Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me on, Al.
When did the story first grab your attention?
It was in the early 2000s or so. I was working at the Wall Street Journal, and I had been following North Korea since the early 1980s. But sometime, you know, maybe in the late 1990s or around the year 2000, I began to hear about people who were getting out. And their numbers were and are very small, but they've been getting out first out of North Korea, usually by themselves, and then across China with the help of brokers or, in many cases, with the help of Christian activists. And in the early 2000s, I began to interview some of these people who had escaped and made their way to South Korea, and then later, starting in 2006, to the United States. Their stories were very compelling, and of course, the horrors that they told about their lives in North Korea were beyond belief, only to be they were also faced with terrible treatment in China. But the stories were also inspiring because it showed the courage, the determination, and the persistence, the drive for freedom that hadn't been quelled after 60 years of totalitarianism.
Yeah. How bad are conditions in North Korea?
When I started researching this book, I knew that they were terrible, but I soon realized they were far worse than even I had imagined after all my years of paying attention to North Korea. The Kim family regime controls just about every aspect of a person's life. Most importantly, whether or not they eat. The family regime, you know, the Kim family determines who gets food and who doesn't. Mm. And at times of food shortages, of course, the food goes to the elites who prop up the regime and to high levels of military people. Ordinary people suffer and suffer badly.
So they control actually the food supply. What about electricity, heating, the normal things that we anticipate for decent households?
That's very erratic, Al. You know, China supplies about 75% of the fuel that North Korea uses. And one person I interviewed, my book, I should say, is really a collection of stories trying to illuminate all of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women I interviewed here in the United States, I was visiting her at her home, and I asked her if there was anything that she missed from North Korea. And her reply was very poignant. She said, "The darkness." She was used to, like so many North Koreans, going to bed when the sun went down, you know, like a medieval peasant or something. When you asked about life in North Korea, let me mention one other thing that really astonished me, and that is the level of violence in North Korean society. We all have heard now about the concentration camps, about the gulag, where about 250,000 people are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And many, of course, do not survive. But there are many levels of prisons in North Korea. And if you commit what is perceived, deemed to be a political crime, you know that you will go to jail. Of course, there's no rule of law. But you won't go alone because the regime practices a form of collective punishment whereby your parents and your children will go off to prison with you and may not survive.
Oh. My guest is Melanie Kirkpatrick. She's the author of Escape from North Korea. It's the untold story of Asia's Underground Railroad. And what is the exact relationship now between... Are we still at war with North Korea? I mean, what happened? What has been declared since the Korean War? Is there an armistice in place?
That's right. There is no peace treaty. The war was suspended in 1953, and the demilitarized zone was created along the 38th parallel. That's a 2.5 mile wide strip that divides the north and the south. And despite its name, the demilitarized zone, it is the most militarized border in the world, probably.
Landmines and things.
There are a million landmines there. Mm-hmm. There is barbed wire on each side and lots of troops guarding each side. It's very difficult and very rare for any North Korean to escape through the DMZ. However, in early October, a soldier did.
Mm.
And he was at a guard post, assigned to a guard post on the North Korean side of the DMZ, and he shot both of his superior officers and made a dash across the line to the south and was immediately accepted, of course.
Wow. So did he know where these landmines were? I mean, did he have?
Well, he was actually at he was at a crossing point.
Okay.
He must have been a very trusted soldier to have been given such a post.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he of course betrayed his superiors and in favor of freedom.
I'm wondering, you've interviewed a good number of people here. I'm curious, do they, from living in a totalitarian regime, what do they find most difficult to acclimate to
mm-hmm.
once they're out from behind that border?
That's a key question. There's a section in my book about how they, you know, are learning to be free. American slaves who went north had the same issue to deal with. And, the modern frenetic pace of South Korean society is, of course, new to them. But and the choices are sometimes overwhelming. I interviewed a pianist. He had been the first pianist of the Pyongyang Philharmonic Orchestra.
Wow.
And I asked him about this, and he said the hardest thing he's had to learn since he got to South Korea was deciding what to play. Why did he escape? He escaped because he was had been illegally playing jazz, and somebody threatened to report him.
Oh, my.
So now he gets to South Korea, and it's very hard for him to just make such decisions. But these North Koreans often spend a number of years in China before they escape. And
how is that? How does that work?
Well, the way it works is that because they can't go south across the DMZ, they go north to China and cross one of the rivers bordering North Korea to China.
Are they free to do that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
They have to make a run for freedom, and they risk, you know, being shot in the back.
Kind of funny, a run to freedom into China.
Yes. No, that's a very, hard concept for an American to get their minds around. But to a North Korean, of course, China and the freedoms it affords are, something that's better beyond belief.
Oh, yeah. It's considerably better, sure.
But China's policy is both immoral and in contravention of its obligations under international treaties it signed. Its policy is to track down the North Koreans, arrest them, and send them back to North Korea.
Really?
And because it's a crime to leave North Korea, North Koreans who are repatriated are very harshly dealt with. Oh. They're sent to jail, they're tortured, they may not survive.
Mm. I want to come back on the other side of the break and continue conversation, but you said something that piqued my curiosity, and that is this pianist who wanted to play jazz, and he was under suspicion for playing jazz. I'm curious, are there other aspects of pop culture up there? I mean, I don't know what the political argument would be against jazz. You know what I'm saying? I'd have to work on that.
Uh-huh.
But I'm curious if there are other aspects of pop culture that are forbidden in North Korea. And if you know, I'd like to know how do they perceive the political threat from these pieces of pop culture? We'll come back on the other side of the break. Melanie Kirkpatrick, my guest, she's written Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. We're going to continue on the other side of the break. I'm Al Cresta, and you're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, your national and local online business directory, connecting Christian business professionals with Catholic consumers. Advertisers have taken a stand to support Christian family values in the marketplace. It's important to support businesses that embrace life and promote the gospel of Christ. And at CatholicBusinessPages.com, business professionals have taken that stand. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
And now a word of encouragement from Mark Shea at CatholicExchange.com.
Most people have the idea that humility involves making oneself into a cocker spaniel, a dartboard, or a doormat. But in reality, humility is the sort of glad self-forgetfulness we sometimes experienced in childhood. The child who is simply ecstatic with admiration for a baseball hero or filled with wonder at the marvel of a simple magic trick is living out the Christian ideal of humility in a certain way. Such a child is simply so focused on a good thing that he does not have room for self-absorption. Of course, as adults, inevitably we become more self-aware. When we do, the call of Christ is not to put ourselves down or to spend a lot of time trying not to think of ourselves, which is, of course, one of the most self-absorbed things we can do. Rather, it is to hold on to the original insight of childhood and find what is excellent and admirable in those around us. When we do, we find the becoming so interesting that we can't be bothered fussing about ourselves. I'm Mark Shea for CatholicExchange.com.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
If you ask most Catholics which is Rome's most important church, they'll say St. Peter's. In one sense, they're right. These days, St. Peter's is certainly the most celebrated, the most visible church. It's near the Vatican and where the Pope lives and works. But there's another more important church at the Lateran. It's his more ancient palace and seat of government. It's the official Mother Church of Rome, and hence for us. And Catholics all over the world today celebrate its dedication. Now, many reasons can be chosen for today's Mass. I chose John. Jesus wants his church to be a pure church, a holy church. You are called to be pure. You are called to be holy. You are called to be consecrated to God. You are called to resurrection. When the Passover was at hand, Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and in the temple he found them selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers at their business. Making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and spilled the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. Take these things away, he said. You shall not make my Father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, Zeal for thy house will consume me. And this zeal did consume him. Jerusalem was a pilgrimage city. Religion was his big business. And for attacking that system, Jesus had to be put down. But by his death and resurrection, he has set us free. Blessed be God. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Melanie Kirkpatrick, author of Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. On the other side, earlier she had described one fellow who had escaped from North Korea, a pianist who was held a prominent place within the Pyongyang Symphony Orchestra. And in going to, one of the things he had difficulty acclimating to when he went into when he entered freedom was deciding what pieces to play. His repertoire, all of a sudden, you know, he had options he never had before. But one of the things he wanted to do in North Korea was to play jazz, and he was under suspicion because he played jazz. This is the kind of thing he'd be reported on. You know, there's the Swing Kids story from Nazi Germany where the Germans didn't like jazz either. They thought it was a debasing type of music. They're Nazis anyways. I'm wondering, what was the rationale against jazz, and what other types of pop culture were rejected?
Well, the North Korean pianist explained it to me as the following. He said that jazz is seen as vicious music that confuses people's minds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you make an interesting comparison with the Nazis, who also disliked it. Well, so did the Soviets.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah, in 1958, Dave Brubeck, the great American jazz pianist, went to Warsaw. And, of course, he plays jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And he said at the time that no dictatorship can tolerate jazz, and that he called it the first sign of a return to freedom.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's a delightful story.
So, but as far as other pop culture is concerned, the reason that the North Korean dictators, the Kim family, dislike pop culture is that they can't control it.
Yep.
So South Korean soap operas, TV soap operas, have in recent years grown in popularity in North Korea. They're smuggled in to North Korea.
Oh, boy.
And people, you know, watch them. And, of course, the same is true with some Korean popular music.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's all banned, but people seem to be, and in a way, it's a little act of resistance.
Yeah,
you watch a
yeah.
South Korean soap opera, well, and you're challenging your government.
Well, you are, because soap operas are interesting in that they're supposed to depict normal life, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole setting would be different. The type of living rooms that they would see, any automobiles that might be on those programs. But just think of the settings in most soap operas. Those would be shocking, I think, to North
Absolutely.
Koreans.
Absolutely. Yeah. I interviewed a North Korean woman, a dancer, whose story I tell in my book. And she described how... you know, in North Korea, she'd seen one of these banned soap operas, and she made the mistake of telling a friend that she believed what she saw in it, and she was denounced, so she had to leave.
Oh.
But, you know, she spoke with the food that she saw on the table, and with amazement, and she was a member of the elite, yet still she saw how elaborately, by her standards, mm-hmm. People lived. Also, you know, many North Koreans have never been in a car. They've maybe been in a truck or on a bus, but they've never been in a car. So they see South Korean families getting into the family car.
Mm.
Wow. So, and then just the way they interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or imagine this. In North Korea, it is a requirement that every family have a portrait of the two elder Kim family members on the walls of their homes, mm-hmm. Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of keep the portraits clean and bow down and worship them.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a North Korean who escaped, and he was here in this country, and he, as I was leaving, he pointed to a photograph of his family on the wall of their living room, and he said, "This is the difference between North Korea and America. Here, I can put a picture of myself on the wall. In North Korea, I have to have a picture of Kim Il Sung on the wall."
That's great. That's a great line. I know that you mentioned earlier activists who are helping. You mentioned Christian activists. I know that South Korea, over the last generation, has had a very lively evangelical Protestant and Pentecostal surge. I also know Catholicism has been strong in South Korea.
Yes.
How does... it's got to be a very different... Given that men and women of faith have a very high understanding of the human person, they also believe in that, you know, life goes on beyond the grave. They've got much wider horizons. And is there much family interaction between North and South Korea? And if so, what about the religious communication, the spiritual communication between the two?
Let me begin by answering your question to say that your assumptions are incorrect. Religion is banned in North Korea and has been for 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very serious crime to practice any kind of religion. People have been executed for the crime of possessing a Bible.
Yes.
And second, you referred to communication across the border, and all communication is also banned.
Mm-hmm.
Families that have been divided for 60 years have no idea whether their relatives are alive or dead. That said, one of the very important effects of the people who've escaped from North Korea is that they've been able to get information back into North Korea through clandestine means. And they've developed a black market in information, and that includes information about Christianity.
Hmm.
And there are reports, it's very difficult to confirm these things, but there are reports, and I heard many of them, that there are Christians secretly practicing their faith in North Korea.
Wow. That would be frightening. A tough environment. What, who reaches out, what Christian communities are most active in helping to create this underground railroad for North Koreans?
Mm-hmm. It's very ad hoc. It is not an organized organization at all. There are individual churches in South Korea and in the United States, and there are also individual people who reach out, who make the decision to go to China to help North Koreans. I might add that one of the reasons it is not well organized or coordinated is out of the necessity of keeping it secret.
Right, right.
It's a crime in China to offer any assistance to a North Korean. And Americans have gone to jail for helping North Koreans. They've been expelled for helping North Koreans, and many more South Koreans have gone to jail for that. But the Christians, these are all Christians, and some are humanitarian workers who are not Christian, but these are people who understand what they're doing and are willing to take this risk.
Mm-hmm.
But my heart goes out most of all to the local Chinese Christians.
Yes, I was going to ask if they were in South Korea or in China.
In China. Okay. Yeah, in China, when a North Korean crosses the border to China, he often is fleeing, trying to find something to eat. He may not have a plan about how he's going to, you know, hide in China, or even whether he's going to stay in China or try to go, you know, to the south, go to South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
The first survival tip he learns when he gets to China is find a Christian.
Interesting.
Because he'll hear that church people help North Koreans.
Hmm.
And Chinese Christians are at particular risk, of course, because they live there, and they could be treated harshly, they could be treated badly. So I really admire them. I met one Chinese man who, with his wife, run an orphanage for the children of North Korean women who have been sold as brides to Chinese men. And these kids, in some cases, are, you know, left destitute because their mothers are arrested and sent back to North Korea, or their mothers decide to leave on the Underground Railroad, and the fathers either can't take care of them or don't want to take care of them.
Do those who cross into China and they seek out the assistance of Christians, do they have conversion experiences, or are they, you know, what we used to call rice Christians?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's impossible to see into anybody's heart,
sure,
to know the true nature of their belief. But, I've interviewed so many North Koreans now who've become Christian, and I think that many of their conversions are genuine. One perhaps test is that when they reach South Korea, many of them remain Christians.
Yes, yes.
And there it's the South Korean government that is providing the assistance to them, although the church community in South Korea also helps them through various aid programs. But I interviewed one North Korean woman who had been a member of the Workers' Party in North Korea, and she told me she at first was tricked into studying Christianity. The man who was helping her with some business she was doing in China told her he wouldn't pay her the money he owed her unless she attended a believer's course. So she did,
sure.
Just because she wanted her money.
Of course.
But then she told me it took hold.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Somehow later on she decided, this is what she wanted. And so she spent a few years in China. She eventually escaped to South Korea, and she became a pastor there.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it is interesting.
Hi. they have to leave China and then come into South Korea. Is that common, or do they? How many? What percentage? Do they have any idea of how many actually make their way to South Korea, and how many remain in China?
Well, I have yes to the former and no for the latter. South Korea keeps very close track of how many North Koreans come to South Korea, and since the end of the Korean War in 1953, there have been roughly 24,000 North Koreans, and more than half of them, well more than half of them, have arrived in South Korea in the past 10 years or 12 years.
My guest is Melanie Kirkpatrick. We're taking a look at the Underground Railroad, North Korea from China into South Korea. We're going to continue on the other side of the break. I'm Al Cresta.
Faith, family, and the culture of life. It's Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak.
A friend of mine likes to say, show me a culture that despises chastity, and I'll show you a culture that despises childhood. What he means is that when a culture makes an idol out of promiscuous sex, children suffer the consequences by becoming sexualized earlier and earlier. Although this makes sense from a Catholic standpoint, secular society finally seems to be catching on. The American Psychological Association's Task Force on the Sexualization of Girls recently issued a report finding that children 10 years old and younger are experiencing the kinds of serious body image and self-image problems that used to be experienced primarily by older teen girls. The task force found that the consumer-driven push to sexualize younger and younger children is resulting in higher incidence of eating disorders, poor self-image, and depression among elementary school girls. It's time for parents to fight back. Stop buying dolls that glorify the pop sex diva culture. Stop giving your little girls permission to have or attend immodest pop princess makeover parties. Say no to immodest fashions and encourage your daughters to dress in a manner that reflects their inner beauty and status as a daughter of God. I'm Dr. Gregory Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
You've been listening to Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak. To discover more resources for living an abundant life, including books, CDs, and Catholic counseling services, visit us online at exceptionalmarriages.com.
Can't listen 24/7? Go to AveMariaRadio.net and subscribe to the Ave Maria Radio podcast. Listen to your favorite Ave Maria Radio program or download them to your computer or handheld device. We've been storing Ave Maria Radio programs since 2007. Then stay on our website to learn about the great organizations that support Ave Maria Radio. Now you have even more reasons to become a radioactive Catholic by going to AveMariaRadio.net.
We're here with Bert Gezzi, author of Voices of the Saints. And today, Bert, we're going to talk about Saint Radegund, a 6th century saint whose feast day we celebrate on August 13th.
Radegund was a queen and a wife of a very abusive king, Clothair, back in what we call, some people call the Dark Ages. And I don't like to call them Dark Ages because there are bright lights like Radegund who appear all the time in the period. She had been kidnapped at age 12 and forced to marry Clothair, but she was a good wife to him. But when he killed her favorite brother, she asked to be separated, which is interesting because she, when she was separated, she went to Poitiers in France and she founded a convent where she lived the rest of her life. Clothair tried to grab her back, but the Bishop of Poitiers intervened and persuaded Clothair to lay off, and he even became a benefactor of the convent.
Wow.
Radegund insisted that the nuns pray and study and work. She was a great mistress for the sisters, an extraordinary lady, very tough, but very gentle at the same time, and herself was a great student of Scripture, became quite a literate lady in Scripture and secular studies when she was in the convent. Because she was tough-minded and served people, she was often corrected by her friends. One friend said, you know, Sister Radegund, if you insist on kissing lepers, nobody's going to want to kiss you. And she said, well, if you don't want to kiss me, I won't mind it at all. I think she's a great example for Christian wives. Women in abusive relationships could do all they can to be good to their husbands, but if it becomes unbearable, separation is a fine approach. You know, she was separated and yet became a saint. Separation may be the thing that has to happen in the worst kinds of abusive relationships, and Catholic women can still expect to be holy if they do that.
Good news for us there from Saint Radegund, whose feast day we celebrate on August 13th. And that's Bert Gezzi, author of Voices of the Saints.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. It is a crime to leave North Korea, and yet increasing numbers of North Koreans are daring to flee. First, they head over to neighboring China, which rejects them as criminals, then on to Southeast Asia or Mongolia, and finally to South Korea, the United States, and other free countries. And they have a secret route known as the New Underground Railroad. My guest, Melanie Kirkpatrick, has been detailing stories of those who have come across Asia's Underground Railroad. The book is called Escape from North Korea. The South Korean government is very much involved watching or monitoring these North Koreans that come in. Do they offer any official assistance once they're there?
Yes, they do. The South Korean government provides a three-month training program for North Koreans when they arrive in South Korea, and they learn such things as the true history of the Korean War, and instead of the propaganda that the others have learned, they learn how to navigate a subway or an ATM machine, how to operate a computer. The computer classes are extremely popular. They also learn the South Korean language, which has developed, you know, in a different direction since the Koreas were separated, and it includes a lot of English language, you know, cognates that are now part of the language. And they also are given some vocational training, and when they leave this resettlement program, they are assisted in finding jobs. They're given a place to live, and they also receive some money from the government to help them get started. There are also nonprofit agencies that help them as well. It's very difficult, though, for a lot of North Koreans there because, you know, Korea is a very family-oriented society, and many of the North Koreans arrive without any family members. So it's tough for them to, you know, feel comfortable there. They also have a hard time learning North Korean work skills, South Korean, pardon me, work skills. Just if you think of it a minute, the skills that help you survive in a totalitarian state are kind of to be passive and not call attention to yourself, where it's just the opposite of what you need to survive in a fast-paced, hardworking society like South Korea's.
Mm-hmm. You tell a story here, which surprised me, of American evangelist Billy Graham visiting Pyongyang in 1994 at the invitation of Kim Il-sung. What was that about?
Well, you know, Kim Il-sung, and I would say like his son and grandson after him, Kim Il-sung was great at international PR. And so the Graham family has a long association with Korea. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Graham, the late Mrs. Graham, Billy Graham's wife, who went with him, was the daughter of missionaries in China. She went to high school in Pyongyang. Pyongyang was so Christian, and in Korea, but the northern part of Korea especially, was so Christian, you know, at the time in the first half of the first three decades of the 20th century, that Pyongyang was known as the Jerusalem of the East.
I didn't know that.
And so the Grahams went there at his invitation, and Kim Il-sung was, you know, as Billy Graham told me, Kim Il-sung regaled them with stories of his childhood when his parents took him to church. And it's very hard to believe when you consider that he went on to create the system whereby he was worshipped as God.
Was Billy Graham able to conduct any open-air meetings there?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. I believe he went to one of the show churches. There are three or four churches in Pyongyang, including one Catholic church, though Mass cannot be celebrated because no priests there. But the assumption is that these are not true practicing Christians, but people who have been put there to pretend they're Christians and show the world that actually Christianity exists there, which, of course, it doesn't.
Right, right. What is the ideology of North Korea? The Kim family is central to it, I guess, but I realize I don't understand what is the kind of world picture or world view that they would hold there.
Well, there are a couple of ways to answer that question. One is to say that any totalitarian ruler, any dictator, is all about control.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, you know, true in a very hyper sense in North Korea, that, you know, the first priority is to control everything in every person's life. Secondly, the Kim family dynasty seems to have this sense of Korea as and the Korean race, quote unquote, as a a pure unsullied kind of race.
Okay.
So for example, if a North Korean woman in China is repatriated to North Korea and she's pregnant, it is assumed that the father of the unborn child is Chinese,
mm-hmm.
and the woman is forced to abort, or if the child is near term, the child is born and killed.
Oh, my.
The reason for this is because they don't want the Korean race to be intermingled with what they see as the Chinese race.
Oh.
It's impure.
Yes, yes.
So,
huh. What do they do any scientific research in North Korea? I mean, just I can't imagine with what we know about genetics and everything that they'd be able to maintain any plausible pure race notions.
Yeah, I'm unaware of that.
Yeah, I it's amazing to me.
Well, their way, is just to keep everybody in and keep the world out.
Yeah.
The best
yeah.
that they can.
Now, the Christian groups that are helping here are kind of ad hoc. There's no central authority. They work best in secret, it sounds like. Well, I'd say it, but I mean, under those circumstances, there are also unscrupulous people.
Indeed.
Who, take advantage of the goodwill of others and the innocence of others.
Yes.
So what did you see along those lines?
Well, you're absolutely right that there are unscrupulous brokers and there are stories. These are, of course, hard to come by, but they're stories of people who, North Koreans, who don't make it because the person who they hired to help them has absconded with the money put them in a perilous situation. That said, this is also a business, and if a broker is going to stay in business, he has to deliver. And so a number of the Christian activists work hand in hand with brokers. There's a synergy there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The Christians have experience and know whom to trust and whom not to trust, and so they sometimes work together. Some of the humanitarian and Christian activists refuse to work with brokers, but many of them realize that their job will be easier and more likely to be successful if they work with brokers as well.
My guest is Melanie Kirkpatrick. The story, Escape from North Korea, the Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. What are unification dumplings?
Unification dumplings is a wonderful story. A North Korean woman who escaped, got to South Korea. A few years after she'd been there, she started a dumpling factory, and she called it Unification Dumplings, expressing her hope for unification of the country. And it's a wonderful story because here's a woman whose business and creative potentials were unleashed because she was in a free society. She worked a couple of jobs for a few years, saved up her money, got a loan from the government, and then set up this factory, which employs a couple of dozen people. Most of them are North Korean refugees. And on the side, she runs a dance troupe made up of North Koreans who've escaped.
She's busy. She's busy.
Well, she's an example of a North Korean who succeeded spectacularly.
How many adapt well?
You know, it's very hard to say. I don't know the answer to that. I can generalize and say that, you know, the younger a person is, the more likely he is to succeed. Just as we saw after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, younger people were able to adjust and adapt and learn more quickly than older people. But it's hard to say.
Yeah.
But also, you know, a lot of these people are there on their own, and it's very lonely, and they feel very guilty, survivor's guilt about leaving families behind.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that would be difficult. What is their understanding of... what do they anticipate? I guess, you know, if we're here in the United States, of course, we think of the United States as a great beacon of liberty and freedom. And I've growing up here in the United States, that's been just part of our own identity as a nation. And I've never thought, if you're living in an information-poor society like North Korea, you get some idea that there's freedom in South Korea. You learn that you've got to go this route through China. But what do you know about democracy? What do you know about free markets? What do you truly anticipate you're going to get for the danger that you're undertaking?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I don't think North Koreans have a sophisticated sense at all of what to expect in South Korea or another free society, because all they've ever known is this closed totalitarianism that they've lived under. But that said, they want something that's better than what they have.
Mm.
And I'll also add that thanks to those who've escaped and this black market in information that they've created, North Koreans still in North Korea are, from what I can tell, beginning to get an idea of what the rest of the world is like. This is very important. There is no dissent in North Korea today. But... information is perhaps one of the first steps to creating a desire among peoples for something different than what they have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I urge in my book, I urge that we try to support and increase these information, this information trail. We want to get more information into the country.
Are there groups that we can communicate with that, you know, we could contribute to, or we could, you know, somehow help?
Well, there are many groups of exiles working in South Korea that have set up radio shows that broadcast into North Korea, that are dropping leaflets in North Korea, that are dropping DVDs. One even has an e-book on democracy on it.
Nice. Well, Melanie, thank you so much for joining us today. It's, again, fascinating. I've never given this serious thought until I read your book. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Melanie Kirkpatrick. It's called Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, your national and local online business directory, connecting Christian business professionals with Catholic consumers. Advertisers have taken a stand to support Christian family values in the marketplace. It's important to support businesses that embrace life and promote the gospel of Christ. And at CatholicBusinessPages.com, business professionals have taken that stand. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. Don't miss the holiday classic, The Best Christmas Pageant Ever, beginning Thursday, November 29th, and running through the weekend at Stone Arch Event Center in Saline. The Herdsmans bully their way into the best roles in the church Christmas pageant. Will they ruin it? For ticket information, call 734-316-2465 or visit SalineAreaPlayers.org. Holy Spirit Church in Brighton invites you to the Christian Origins of the Lord of the Rings, Saturday, December 1st. Dr. Henry Russell will present the intentions behind J.R.R. Tolkien's masterpiece just in time for the release of The Hobbit. For further details, call 810-231-9199. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio, it's yours to keep and to grow.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Light of the East on Ave Maria, we answer the question that many people seem to ask today. Byzantine Catholic churches, where are you? As we hear from a pastor in Texas.
Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 7 on 990 WDEO.
Well, I'll tell you, getting outside of your own skin sometimes is pretty shocking. When you think of living in a country in which you can't count on electricity, you don't have access to information, you have musicians who are afraid of playing jazz or blues or rock, probably. I'd be curious to know even how the classical repertoire shrinks. Because for political considerations. There's not enough food. You're expected to have the pictures of your nation's leaders on your wall. You have forced abortion. You have this belief in a pure race in a day and age in which the rest of the world understands the science of genetics makes it clear that we don't have a pure race anywhere. It's an alternate universe that these men and women grow up with and they die with. And it's right there. North Korea. The book, again, is called Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad. Pray for the liberation of so many of these people in those Christian institutions that are there on the front lines, as usual, helping people to liberty, freedom, and ultimately to Christ.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
We're here with Bert Gezzi, author of Voices of the Saints. And today, Bert, we're going to talk about Saint Radegund, a 6th century saint whose feast day we celebrate on August 13th.
Radegund was a queen and a wife of a very abusive king, Clothair. Back in what some people call the Dark Ages, and I don't like to call them Dark Ages because there are bright lights like Radegund who appear all the time in the period. She had been kidnapped at age 12 and forced to marry Clothair, but she was a good wife to him. But when he killed her favorite brother, she asked to be separated, which is interesting because when she was separated, she went to Poitiers in France and she founded a convent where she lived the rest of her life. Clothair tried to grab her back, but the Bishop of Poitiers intervened and persuaded Clothair to lay off, and he even became a benefactor of the convent.
Wow.
Radegund insisted that the nuns pray and study and work. She was a great mistress for the sisters, an extraordinary lady, very tough, but very gentle at the same time, and herself was a great student of Scripture, became quite a literate lady in Scripture and secular studies when she was in the convent. Because she was tough-minded and served people, she was often corrected by her friends. One friend said, "You know, Radegund, if you insist on kissing lepers, nobody's going to want to kiss you." And she said, "Well, if you don't want to kiss me, I won't mind it at all." I think she's a great example for Christian wives. Women in abusive relationships could do all that.